Tonight on Arena, Boy on Fire, we talk about the young Nick Cave, and John Spillane and Dry Cleaning are among the albums up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Next Monday night, the acclaimed cult mockumentary Wellington Paranormal finally arrives on Irish and UK screens, with seasons 1 to 3 coming to Sky Comedy and Now TV. The series aired in New Zealand in 2018. It stars Mike Minogue and Karen O'Leary as a couple of sceptical police officers whose conspiracy theorist captain enlists them in Wellington Police Force's first paranormal unit. Indeed, all is not what it seems on the streets of New Zealand's capital. And it's not long before our hapless crime-fighting duo come face to face with an army of ghosts and cow-napping extraterrestrials. Chris Wasser has been watching Wellington Paranormal for us, and he joins me now. Chris, before we talk about it, let's hear from the officers O'Leary and Minogue, played by Karen O'Leary and Mike Minogue. And they explain that they've been moved to the paranormal unit and what they're styling themselves on.
She doesn't look well.
The dead shall rise from hell.
Do you need a lozenge or?
Maybe we could call her.
Do you want us to call your parents or a guardian pet?
There will be buckets of blood and a fountain of fire.
She's scaring me, O'Leary. Can you do your bad cop?
Stop that. It's a bit scary.
Hello?
My name is Sergeant Marker. I'd like to have a few words with you, if I may.
Can I call my parents?
That is Karen O'Leary and Mike Minogue, who play Officers O'Leary and Minogue in Wellington Paranormal. Chris Wasser has been watching it for us. Chris, this is a spin-off of another mockumentary, What We Do in the Shadows, in which O'Leary and Minogue had just 5 minutes screen time.
It is, yeah. And What We Do in the Shadows was it was one of my favourite films of 2014. And it was a mockumentary and a flat-share comedy from the minds of Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement. Taika Waititi, we know now as the Academy Award-winning writer and director of Jojo Rabbit, and Jemaine Clement is one half of Flight of the Conchords. But back in 2014, audiences on this side of the world, we were still new to these, you know, up and coming comedy veterans of the Wellington comedy scene. But they gave us this remarkable comedy horror, which is a flat share comedy about a group of vampires starring Waititi and Clement, who, you know, they argue over everything ordinary flatmates would argue over: chores and mess and bills. The only difference is that they're, you know, blood sucking half breeds, and they go out at night, you know, when to do their food shopping. They actually go out at night to feed on the people of Wellington, and along the way they actually, you know, make a new vampire. And there was a scene in this film, and it was a huge success for the boys. They actually pulled it together. It was a very low budget film, but they pulled it together by bringing in some of their comedy peers, some new talents that they had discovered through various clubs and whatnot. And there was a scene where two complete newcomers play these officers. Officers Kyle Minogue — that's not Kylie, it's Kyle Minogue, played by Mike Minogue.
Which and he keeps Karen having O'Leary. To correct people that he is, yes. Kyle, not Kylie, yeah.
He does, yeah. He keeps having to say, the E is silent, the E is silent. But they come and, you know, and investigate this noise disturbance at the flat. And as you said, they're at the top 5 minutes of screen time is all these two guys had. And though the rest of the film, you know, introduced the world to Waititi's brand of, you know, deadpan, sardonic wit, it was those two officers that really left a mark in the mind of Jemaine Clement. And while What We Do in the Shadows has gone on to become a franchise, where, you know, we've actually had a What We Do in the Shadows TV show, also developed and written by Jemaine Clement, he came back to those officers and thought, what if these guys were like a New Zealand Mulder and Scully, and what if we combined, let's say, you know, the sort of mockumentary style of The Office with reality shows like Police 10-7 and, you know, Wellington Police Force, so that it looks as though it's a real cop show. It looks as though we're following these officers around on the beat, you know, at midnight in Wellington, but they're also investigating paranormal activities, and they also kind of bear a similar they kind of bear a resemblance to Mulder and Scully, albeit in a spoof sort of way.
Yes, That was the clip I wanted to play earlier. What we played was a young girl who was possessed, who comes in, and they have that very, as though they're dealing with an ordinary teenage girl. And it's obvious that the young teenage girl is possessed by some awful demon. But let's hear them compare themselves to the X-File duo.
Yes, so we've just been reassigned to the Wellington Paranormal Unit. It's a highly classified unit. Mm. So, yes.
It's top secret. No one else knows about it. Yeah. Savelian Jones. They haven't been briefed on it yet. I mean, to put it in layman's terms, we're kind of like Mulder and Scully. She's like Scully because she's analytical, she's got the brains, and I'm a man with brown hair.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not sure if paranormal phenomena exists.
It's pronounced phenomena.
It's phenomena.
It's phenomena. Another way that we like Mulder and Scully is that we've got sort of an underlying sexual tension going on. Hey.
The pause that says it all. That's Karen O'Leary there playing Officer O'Leary and Mike Minogue playing Kyle Minogue, the other officer in this very attracted to each other couple. So it's a mockumentary. So people are used to that form when you think of The Office. So just explain what it is that format brings to a series and how it adds to the comedy, Chris.
Well, it really does. It takes a formulaic setup, but it also transcends it to become something else entirely, which is this completely original and imaginative comedy horror. So as I said, it's kind of filmed and choreographed in a way that it looks as though it's a reality police show. And these two officers, they think that they're being followed around because, you know, and also the camera crew. And the camera crew are an integral part of it, which I love. But they think that this is going to just be a routine police show. But once they're out in Cuba Street in Wellington at one night, and they come across this girl who seems to be intoxicated, but their police captain, their sergeant, Sergeant Ruwai Maka, played by Maka Pohatu, he thinks that there's something more to it, that she might actually be possessed by a demon. And he shows them this small room. It's almost like a cloakroom in the back of the police department, where he's been developing this paranormal unit of the Wellington Police Force all by himself. And he somehow manages to convince O'Leary and Minogue to join him, despite the fact that they are completely skeptical. I mean, he is a bit dim-witted and goofy. She is, you know, the brains of the operation, despite the fact that she sees all of these strange things happening, but still thinks there might be a logical explanation for it. But they agree, you know, look, we'll play the part of these paranormal investigators if that's what you want us to do. It's still police work. And ever since that first case then, it's as though their eye is open to other strange things that are happening. So throughout the first season, then they come across, you know, the possibility of these cow-napping extraterrestrials. And then later on, the possibility that there might be zombies in Wellington and that they might have to actually, you know, stop a potential zombie apocalypse from happening in the capital. And what I love about it is that the interplay between Minogue and O'Leary, it's so natural, and it's made to look as though it's natural. It's made to look as though these officers are kind of just as, you know, befuddled and bewildered as the camera crew are. And the same way if we were watching a police show, you know, we'd be like, what is that going on? But every time an episode ends, they still think nothing of it. They still think it's just another day at the office, and that really makes it. And going back to that camera crew setup, I love the fact that the camera crew sometimes have to be rescued, that, you know, everybody is always asking, what are they doing here? Why are we being filmed? Because with so many shows that have been, you know, kind of trying to copy what The Office did 23 years ago, they never really explain why anything's being filmed. But in this case, it's just a great reality show that also happens to bring in the paranormal.
OK, well, let's have a third clip, Chris. This one is Officer Minogue and O'Leary are called to a domestic incident, which turns out to be the home of the teenage girl we heard first there. But this time it's her father, Gary, played by Paul Yates, who's possessed, with her mother, played by Gabby MacDonald, describing it as a midlife crisis.
At one time, he was very normal.
What is normal?
Well, this isn't. Okay.
Yeah, that's more in a midlife crisis.
Oh. Gary, can you get down off the roof? The cops are here.
You're breaking the law of gravity, O'Leary.
How did you get up there, sir?
Minogue and O'Leary, we meet again.
I don't think so, mate. Do you know where I live?
Do you play softball?
I am Bazooar.
Bullshit. His name's Gary.
I am Bazooar of the Unholy Realm.
Hey, look, just try and calm yourself, mate.
You should probably come down from there, mate.
He got really angry when our daughter came home late, and she was in a really bad mood. I mean, I don't know. Could have been too much screen time.
Do you want some help?
Oh, no. Look, your neck is going to get really sore and I'm not massaging it tonight.
Have you seen that before?
God, no.
You need to stop that and you really need to listen to your wife, Gary.
You're 47.
47?
Are you alright? You're feeling a bit better?
Hmm. What am I doing on the fridge?
Yeah, so the gentleman calmed down, so we've just let him off with a warning.
Hmm. Turns out he was a different Basil Al. Our original person of interest was his daughter. It turns out that she's seems sort of calmed down now as well, so a bit of a win-win.
I mean, so we can go now, knowing that everyone here's safe.
Hmm. Hmm.
So, of course, the end there is whatever was possessing Gary has now gone into the wife, so that's only going to cause more mayhem. Can it sustain itself? It does each night bring some new comedy, or do you tire of it after a few episodes, Chris?
No, you never tire of it. The first season was made available to me, but as you said at the top, there will be three seasons because this has been going on for a couple of years now in New Zealand, and Jemaine Clement has actually started to shoot season four. They are so short. And, you know, they're so funny and they're so witty that it never, you know, once the credits start rolling, you think, is that the full episode? They're only about 20 minutes in length. So as a result, they never tire and they never stick to the one thing. I mean, in one episode, it's ghosts, the next it's aliens, then it's zombies, and then it's vampires, and then it's, paranormal parties in someone's house. You know, it always takes something grounded and then turns it into something weird. And I think part of the reason as well it doesn't tire is because the two performers, they're quite new to this as well. They're quite new to television. I mean, Mike Minogue was almost plucked from obscurity. You know, he was a part of the alternative comedy scene in Wellington, and he had a podcast, and Jemaine Clement thought, you know, this guy has great timing, great deadpan sense of humor, he will be great for this. Whereas O'Leary, she was actually plucked from a school. She's a teacher, and she's an early childhood teacher who I think it was the parent of one of the children she was teaching was a casting director on What We Do in the Shadows. And she thought that the song and dance routines that she was doing with the kids, you know, she's a natural performer. She might be really good for this. And she's now gone on to become a teacher on the home educational channel in New Zealand throughout COVID-19. And the two guys, you know, you can sense that they're so excited just to have a show of their own. But they're not like, it's not like casting someone big who kind of might, you know, if the performers on screen are tired, we will be too. But I think it does sustain itself very well.
Like what We Do in the Shadows was such a great idea. The idea of these kind of a group of vampires hanging around in a flat, you know, fighting over who does the wash up or who gets the beers in. Does it live up to that standard?
It really does, yeah, because as I said, you know, there's always a danger with taking, you know, minor characters from one film or from one TV show and saying, oh, look, they almost stole the show there, let's give them their own series. And there's always a danger that, you know, it might become oversaturated, that, you know, the joke might become tiresome. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, this thing seems to work. I mean, there's something about that New Zealand's deadpan humour and that very dry, sardonic wit that works extraordinarily well. Well, and Waititi and Clement have actually taken that with and taken that sort of brand of comedy and, you know, spun it out into mainstream entertainment. I mean, it's no surprise that, you know, Waititi has gone, you know, just supernova at this stage in his career. He's directed and written Thor Ragnarok. He's working on the next Thor sequel, Jojo Rabbit. And he is somehow finding a way to sneak that alternative underground Wellington humor into mainstream films, the same with Clement. So this, it's nice to see, you know, that still with a low budget, with a brand new cast, that they can still work magic. And I think the series, I said it earlier, it transcends its formulaic setup. It's you know, there are ingenious one-liners. I mean, the mark of a good comedy series for me is when you finish watching an episode and you want to somehow infuse some of the punchlines into your daily life, which has been very annoying for the people I live with. But for me, that is the mark of a great comedy series.
And finally, the show and its characters were utilized last year in a public service announcement in New Zealand.
They were. I thought this was terrific. And there are 15 episodes, maybe 15 or 16, if you will gobble them up. Basically, O'Leary and Minogue were utilized by the New Zealand police force. And you had broadcaster Clark Gayford, who's actually the fiancé of New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. You had the police commissioner, the real-life police commissioner Andrew Koster, who also appeared in these clips, and they got them together to record these two-minute-long public service announcements just to teach New Zealand, adults and children the best health and safety practices during COVID-19, utilizing that kind of paranormal edge. But you think, how did they produce 16 of these? But they are so brilliant, and they also cleverly utilized O'Leary's musical talents. And if you haven't heard it, go to YouTube now and check out, or after the show, I should say, and check out O'Leary's song, 2 Meters, Please. And the lyrics are just fantastic. The tune will be stuck in your head all day. It's something special, Kay. I really, really love this. And I'm so looking forward to seeing the second season when it arrives next Monday.
Well, seasons 1, 2 and 3 of Wellington Paranormal will be available as a box set from Monday, the 5th of April at 9 p.m. on Sky Comedy and Now TV. Chris Wasser, thank you very much.
Secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires. Hey man, you know you're never coming back. Across the square, across the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with Red Right Hand, a song given worldwide reach by being the theme tune of the TV series Peaky Blinders. But Red Right Hand is a song that reaches way back into the childhood of the singer, songwriter, artist and icon Nick Cave. It goes back to his formative years in Wangaratta in Victoria, Australia. Cave's childhood and adolescence as a springboard to his musical genius is the subject matter of Boy on Fire, The Young Nick Cave by Mark Merdu. And I'm delighted that Mark has joined us now from Australia. Mark, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you. One of the most extraordinary aspects of Boy on Fire is how heavily involved Nick Cave and his family and close friends were in the process. Did he take much convincing?
Well, I guess the answer to that question is yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a very sort of fitful beginning. And it wasn't until Nick and I actually met that there was a sense of deeper commitment to the project. And then the actual journey itself was a bit of a long and twisted path all its own. It was sort of 10 years from beginning till now, maybe even slightly more. And along the way, I sort of abandoned the idea of doing a complete life project, at least in one book, and focused on, you know, kind of your classic portrait of the artist as a young man, because I could see in that sort of nuclear early experience a hell of a lot of things about Nick and his art, and he himself references it all the time, and you can even hear it right up till now in Carnage, actually.
Yes, because you said you were just overawed and overpowered, really, by the breadth of the task you had undertaken. And just after, you know, just being unable to take on the whole project, you just decided, like a whale or something, to eat it bit by bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was turning into my Moby Dick project and I was Captain Ahab. So, you know, it was as much nightmare as dream project. And, I mean, the difficulty with Nick is not just the breadth of his career, but wherever you look into his music, you can go deeper and deeper and get lost in all these rabbit holes. And, you know, one song references another. He's, you know, his work across everything from poetry to music to film scripts to theatre to novels, and there are constant conversations and webs sort of occurring everywhere. And with something like Red Right Hand, which you just played before, I mean, I very quickly realised when I was in his hometown of Wangaratta that on the one hand, it's this sort of mythical storytelling, sort of shadow-like encounter with a very ominous figure that it owes a lot to William Faulkner and barn burning and those kind of sort of American sort of Southern Gothic stories. But at the same time too, when I was in Wangaratta, I looked around and thought, oh my God, you could use Red Right Hand almost as well as you might use Google Maps to walk across town.
Yes, yes. You've spoken too of it, that you more or less, I mean, you had a very long conversation with him where he was happy for you to proceed with the project. But after that, there was a kind of agree to disagree standoff between the two of you.
Well, I mean, as everybody knows, Nick lost his son under very tragic circumstances when Arthur died a few years ago now. And that made Nick feel that much had changed in his life, which, of course, it had. And from his perspective, it rendered everything sort of obsolete and no longer relevant, and he felt he was a different person. I didn't entirely agree with that, and I'd invested 7-8 years of the project. The other thing is, Nick, I think, being realistic about my own problems, I was taking so long to get anything done. I don't think Nick really thought I was ever going to get to the end. And he just had a change of heart at that time. But we've communicated since the book came out, and he's really pleased with the outcome of it, and we're kind of back in a kind of neutral holding zone. So, you know, it's just kind of things are much friendlier again. I don't know if any of us really, if you're honest, and I'm including myself in this, could stand a biography about ourselves on any level if the truth is had.
Of course, of course. And Colin Cave, his father, he comes across as quite a domineering individual, a very artistic man, a very well-read man, but his influence in the household was a very domineering one.
Yeah. I mean, he was a very powerful figure, and if Nick hadn't have become the global superstar that he is, in many respects, a lot of people would refer to Nick as Colin Cave's son. You know, he had a major hand in the state of Victoria in sort of pioneering a whole lot of development in adult education. He was a well-known sort of community sort of theatre director. He was a kind of legendary sort of life-changing teacher. And he also had a lot to do with defining the mythology of Ned Kelly, the sort of famous Australian Irish outlaw, I have to say. So,
yes, that's
and
okay.
The figure of Ned Kelly, yeah, I just thought I'd give that a little plug.
Yes.
But the figure of Ned Kelly, it sort of looms large in Nick's background, and in a way is an icon behind Red Right Hand as well. And it's a kind of, you know, a shadow figure for Nick's own father too, because Nick's father was obsessed with that heritage and history and wrote a defining essay about it. And that influenced Peter Carey's book, The True History of the Kelly Gang. So there are all these, again, these webs that keep kind of pulling together that you're surprised to find and discover.
He was obviously, through his father, an avid reader, and then he was interested in art as well. But was it Caulfield Grammar School then where he would have met the bones of the band that became The Boy Next Door?
Yeah, it was at high school at Caulfield in Melbourne. He'd gone down to Melbourne from Wangaratta as a boarder. He'd actually left Wangaratta in shame, really. It was on the verge of being expelled, and his mother and father, Colin and Dawn, didn't know what to do with him. He was just a very wild, brilliant country boy. And it was in Melbourne, fortunately for him, at school that he met Mick Harvey, who'd become one of his truly great collaborators, the guitarist Roland S. Howard, bassist Tracy Pugh and Phil Calvert, and they formed The Boys Next Door. And that was the absolute nucleus for what became The Birthday Party. And they were the collaborators that launched Nick on the world stage.
Well, will we listen to a track from them? This is Shivers. That's The Boys Next Door and Shivers, and I'm talking to Mark Merdu, the author of The Young Nick Cave, Boy on Fire. So that is the band that then segued into The Birthday Party.
It is indeed. Although they were much more romantic sounding and probably nearer power pop to some extent at that stage of things.
Yes, yes. And you were talking there about Nick as a young boy getting into lots of trouble. And then he went to art college. He was doing so well in art college. He was so good at art. And then he failed his second year and then kind of went back into that kind of delinquent behaviour again. What was that about him?
Well, I think there's a number of factors there. There's probably always a bit of a delinquent about Nick at heart. I think, too, you know, he just was constantly clashing with his father. There was a sort of power struggle, and it's probably a pretty archetypal thing between young men and their fathers that that should occur. And he was not being well received at art school, despite his abilities and his obvious intelligence, and there was a lot of frustration, and that sort of slowly started to pour itself into music and performance.
You have talked to Nick for on many occasions for long periods of time. Is there a difference between the public Nick Cave and that Nick Cave that you got to know and talk to?
I would say Nick in private is a lot funnier. I think he's perhaps gentler. I think those qualities are coming through in the Red Hand Files a lot more in the last few years. You're starting to see, I guess, the real Nick, or the Nick as he is now, rather than how he might have seemed in the past.
Yes. And you build up the story then. And of course, when you decided that you were going to write about the young Nick Cave, you have to decide where you're going to end before you consider maybe going back to the subject matter for other books. How did you decide that it was when they decided to leave Australia and go to Britain was a good place to finish the book?
Well, I felt that was kind of the launching off moment. I think it cleanly carved off the pure sense of him being formed in Australia. I think all his dreams and most of his abilities, both as an artist and a performer, were all intact inside him and ready to burst forth. I did have a vague sense, because he's a big lover of Milton and Paradise Lost, there was almost that demonic edge of in Paradise Lost of Satan travelling across the water to wreak havoc on Eden. And I think Nick was hell-bent on making an impact on England. And I did think that a volume two with about London and Berlin would make another nice section.
And are you going to do that?
Yeah, I am. I've been sort of debating it, because the book took so much out of me, but
yes.
I'm keen to go another step forward.
Well, looking forward to that. And I guess it was Ned Kelly's revenge sent him over to England. So Boy on Fire, The Young Nick Cave by Mark Murdoch is published by Atlantic Books, and we're going to finish now with Sad Waters. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Time now for album reviews. And first up, British band Dry Cleaning have been described by the Enemy as a playful antidote to the po-faced post-punk. Recently signed to Ubercred record label 4AD, their debut album is called New Long Leg, and it's out today. Next, John Spillane, native of Cork, a city he describes as the centre of the universe, brings us an album written in the Irish bardic tradition with strong themes of Irish mythology. It's called 100 Snow White Horses. And finally, Dancing with the Devil, The Art of Starting Over is the title of the new album from American pop star Demi Lovato, released in the wake of a documentary series charting her descent into drug addiction in her first album since her near-fatal overdose in 2018. More of which later with our reviewers today, Simon Marr and Siobhan Kane. But let's start with the band that is setting critical hearts a flutter across the water recently. They are Dry Cleaning, and this is Scratch Card Lanyard.
I've come to join the knitting circle. I've come to hand wave my own bumper ladder in a fusion. short sessions. It's a Tokyo bouncy ball, it's an Oslo bouncy ball, it's a Rio de Janeiro bouncy ball. Filter, I love these mighty oaks, don't you? Do everything and feel nothing. Wristband, theme park, scratch card, lanyard. Do everything, feel nothing.
Florence Shaw's vocal central there in Scratch Card Lanyard from the band Dry Cleaning. For our first album up for review, Siobhan Kane is with me and Simon Marr is on the line. Siobhan, there's a blend of the mundane and the epic at play in the new long leg, isn't there? Where are Dry Cleaning coming from thematically?
Thematically, some listeners might be surprised to hear a bit of a love of Shady Lane by Pavement in there, a big influence in terms of kind of sonically and Stephen Malkmus in particular. But actually, David there mentioned Gang of Four, very much there. Also, late Joy Division, early New Order, of course. And then there's definitely the British kind of later punk, early post-punk, and a bit of John Cooper Clarke in there, who always makes the mundane sound epic. So there's a lot of influences, a little bit of Grace Jones again, which might be a kind of interesting swerve. Florence Shaw quite influenced by that. But
yes, and that kind of spoken song voice she has, and yes, then this really guitar sound around her.
Yes, and they kind of, their sonic flourishes are very interesting because it kind of lives and dies in Florence Shaw's vocal, which she affects the kind of not bothered about anything, but it is arch and artful. And they began as an instrumental band until Florence came in one day with, you know, reams of kind of adverts that she'd found and her own scribbles, and just started to kind of sing speak. And then that's kind of how this emerged.
Simon, as Siobhan is describing there, Dry Cleaning are serious about what they do, but they're not po-faced, are they? They're, you know, she kind of, you know, throws up her eyes as she speaks those lyrics.
She does indeed, and it's one of the things that's about that I've spent most of my life listening to bands who take themselves incredibly seriously. And even when you listen to the start of any of the songs, you know that without Florence, and without, well, I suppose without the lightness of touch that they all have, but without the lyrics in a lot of these songs, they would have sounded like 100 other indie bands. Very, very tight and really, really good musicians, but it could have been very dense and very, very dark. But suddenly, by adding in this lightness, particularly this lyrical lightness that they have, you know, it really, it's an immediate lift that you get from this band.
Yeah, Simon, the lyrics are quite idiosyncratic, aren't they? Give us a sense of the subject matter.
There's great, it's everything, right? But a lot of it is very, very mundane. Like, she talks at one stage about somebody deciding to go to the loo on her leg in a big Sainsbury's. There's some great T-shirt slogans, more espresso, less depresso, less depresso as well. And a really, really good one where she's talking about hot and sunny weather. And it's the stuff that everybody thinks. You know, she talks about how great she is in her hippo. So these idiots in trousers, they don't know what they're doing. But it's the way it's delivered, and it's the backing that it's delivered over. It's great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about that delivery, Siobhan.
Well, actually, Simon brought up a few gems there. One of my favourites is from Strong Feelings, where she says, just an emo, dead stuff collector, as I think we all are. And she kind of, she pitches it so beautifully, because she sounds, again, like someone that isn't bothered in every kind of, you know, from Claire Danes, My So-Called Life, you know, this kind of, I really don't care about anything, you know, perpetual teenager until you're 98 years old. But it takes a great deal of artfulness to sound not bothered in any way. So she's pitching it, not just the mundane, making it epic, but she also, the delivery is incredibly deadpan.
All right. Well, we listened to her hippo that Simon referenced just there.
Safe inside a secret love, let's run. Anyway, mystical Shakespeare shoes, a trapped person screaming. The last thing I looked at in this hand mirror was a human arsehole. Well, Helen's situation has really put all that in the shade now. There he goes, he doesn't care.
That's Her Hippo from New Long Leg by Dry Cleaning. And Siobhan Kane and Simon Marr have been listening to our albums tonight. Siobhan, the guitarist there, he's very distinctive.
Yes, Tom Dowse. Again, you know, as been mentioned, Simon said, you know, without Florence, this would sound like maybe 100 indie bands that we've heard before, but there is something quite beautiful going on, and they're very singular guitar lines, but also very shoegazy in parts. And Tom and Florence met originally at the Royal College of Art in London. Both very idiosyncratic, both love illustration, both really connected on that level. So there's a lot going on as well, I think, between those two, you know, guitar and Florence, and then Lewis and Nick kind of shoring everything up. But yes, that's something I think as well, thematically, in terms of the sonic flourish, that the guitar is incredibly special on this record.
And Simon, John Parrish is the producer here. What does he bring to the dry cleaning sound?
Yeah, I think he spent so much time working with PJ Harvey over the years. And PJ Harvey, again, a really, really unique talent, but an incredibly unique vocal as well. And I think there was always that risk that it was all going to become very, very mushy. And you would have had, you know, that great vocal, but it would have been way back in a mix somewhere. But what he's managed to do is he's managed to bring it out. And because the musicians are so strong, and what Siobhan says about Tom Day's guitar is absolutely right, that the fact that he's managed to get that mix right and not drown it in production mush adds to this album.
Yeah, it's such a strange mix, but it works. Marks out of five, stars out of five from you, Simon.
I think this is really good. I'm going to give this 4 stars out of 5.
4 out of 5 from Simon. And from you, Siobhan?
And that's a consensus. I'm giving it 4 as well.
4 out of 5 and 4 out of 5 for Dry Cleaning, New Long Leg. Next to Cork's finest, John Spillane, who returns with his new album, 100 Snow White Horses. And Siobhan, he's still drawing on his perpetual muse of Cork City.
He does. There's diversity here in that he also mentions places like Spanish Point and Clare.
He takes a trip beyond his 5K.
He does, and he actually said because of everything, I guess, that we're living amid at the moment in the pandemic, it's made the local become the universal for with our 5K and so on. But it's also that the perpetual muse is Cork, but he said these 11 songs are also emblematic of 11 journeys he took when he gave concerts. So they're actually inspired by going to play in different places across the country.
Okay, let's listen to Bishopstown, and this is from 100 Snow White Horses from John Spillane.
Houses dancing on and on, Cherry Grove, La Burnham Lawn, the milk of human kindness flows, the sweet suburban breezes blow, the summer sun shines calmly down on Bishopstown, on Bishopstown.
That's Bishopstown from 100 Snow White Horses from John Spillane, and Siobhan Kane and Simon Marr have been listening to it for us. Simon, he talks about the bardic tradition and he sees himself as one of these rambling, travelling bards around Cork and around other places like Spanish Point that Siobhan mentioned. Do you get that sense from it?
You do. There's something very much journeyman about somebody like John Spillane. And when he's talking about somewhere really, really local, like that track that you just played, Bishopstown, it's an incredibly local sense that he gives you. But like he goes on, there's other tracks on the album. You know, one of the singles, the first single that was taken from it, We Come With The Wind, talks about the voyage of Bran and the voyage of St. Brendan. So he's able to take these from the incredibly local up to the biggest, broadest mythological stories he's able to do. But what he's able to do is he's able to do this in an almost effortless sort of a way, because he can be listening and he's talking about, you know, city streets in Cork, or he can be talking about mythology of 1,000 years ago. And even though you may not be familiar with the places or the people or the time, he's able to bring you into the story. And that's where that bardic thing is that you know that he's telling a story, and he's not just telling you a good story, but he's telling a good story well.
Yes, I think you really like that storytelling element to the work, Siobhan.
Yes, he's kind of, it's funny just hearing there Bishopstown in studio, you know, later John Spillane sounds a little Christy Moore-like as well. And there's that kind of, as Simon said, the journeyman. But he also, this one for me as well, the entire record, the sonic kind of flourishes almost took away from his, if you strip back to his vocal, that's what you want to hear. And when you see him live, he really lives in the live moment where you feel he's bringing you in, coaxing you in, telling you a story as if you were by the fire.
Right, so you thought a little overproduced
In some ways. There's one in particular called Billy in the Sky, which kind of is more Chiba meets the bardic tradition, that was a kind of, for me, not so much... kind of as an attractive kind of sound for me, because he does bring you in, and that kind of pushed me out of the dream for a little.
All right, well, we'll listen to the title track and I'll ask you about what Siobhan said then, Simon. This is 100 Snow White Horses.
100 torches blazing in the march of the kings of Leash, in the march of the kings of Leash. 100 snow white horses, 100 golden bridles, the silver reins a jingling in the march of the kings of Leash. 7 royal banners.
That's the title track, 100 Snow White Horses, there from John Spillane. Simon, Siobhan was saying she felt it a little overproduced at times.
I think it's always going to be the hardest thing for somebody like John Spillane to do, is to translate that live feel down onto a record. And listening to it, I was listening to it as I was walking and I had my headphones on, and it made me so sad for not being able to hear live music at the moment. Because even as you're listening, and particularly as you're listening to that song, I'm thinking of him in Whelan's and absolutely silencing the place listen to those stories, you know. And it makes you feel the loss, the current loss of live music even more.
Indeed it does. Stars out of 5 for 100 Snow White Horses, Simon.
I am going to give it 4.
4. And from you, Siobhan?
A 3 for me.
A 3. But bring back live music and more of John Spillane live. Finally this evening, to Demi Lovato's 7th studio record, Dancing with the Devil, The Art of Starting Over, which comes after a period of recovery and reflection after her overdose in 2018. This was also recorded in tandem with the documentary series of the same name, which she has called, in chronological, non-official soundtrack to the documentary. I just woke up from drinking not half of a cup. The universe is trying to remind me. Give me a pen, I'm rewriting another ending. It didn't turn out the way that I wanted. I had the armor, I wore it much in the summer, but the arrow hit me right where the heart is. I guess I'm mastering. Well, as anyone would know, that wasn't anyone. It was The Art of Starting Over from Dancing with the Devil, The Art of Starting Over by Demi Lovato. And I probably said anyone because anyone was kind of the trigger that at the Grammys, when really she was in no fit state to be performing.
That's right. And that kind of came as well with the unreleased documentary that was happening at the time, coming off the back of her world tour for her 2017 record. And actually, the first three, you heard there, The Art of Starting Over. What prefaces that on this record of 19 songs is three songs which are kind of the kind of breakdown, maybe, essentially. And then she does a spoken word intro. And then you've got the up-tempo, kind of almost doo-wop inspired that you just played there. So she is going through, she doesn't kind of look away from the ugliness. And the first few songs are very much about that. And then she kind of gives us the chronological reflection and recovery and kind of healing aspect to the journey she's on currently, actually.
Now, Simon, I know you don't like people to, you know, be too self-reflective, but obviously the woman has been through a very difficult time. So it's not unexpected that she would write about that.
No, absolutely not. And you know what's probably, I probably almost expected more of it in this album because of the fact that she's always been so open about everything, going back to the 10 years since she became, I suppose, a child star on Disney. You know, and to come up to, and as you listen to the first, I suppose, 15, 20 minutes of the album, it completely stops you in your tracks, because even when she's doing anyone, she's asking people, you know, why aren't you listening? But as it goes on into the album, the impact is there. But because there's 19 songs and because it is chronologically correct, but not necessarily musically compelling, I feel that it starts to dilute the message that she has and this shocking story that she has to tell, maybe that little bit.
All right. Well, look, we've talked about Anyone, so we should play just a little piece of it.
I tried and tried and tried some more. Told secrets till my voice was sore. Tired of empty conversation, 'cause no one hears me anymore. 100 million stories and 100 million songs. I feel stupid when I sing. Nobody's listening to me. Nobody's listening.
So that there was Anyone from Dancing with the Devil, The Art of Starting Over from Demi Lovato. The songs are incredibly confessional, aren't they? Are you shocked by what's revealed?
No, and I think Simon alluded to it there earlier that she's always been incredibly open from her time, you know, from her first release in 2008. She's written books, she's had other documentaries in previous years about her journey through sobriety. The thing for me is probably I'm always very uncomfortable when people are too confessional, particularly in the 21st century, but that's just me. It's more the fact as well, the production is strangely sterile for a subject that is incredibly life-changing and
Roger.
Passionate.
All right.
Okay, Roger. Will we... stars out of five.
I'd give it a low three.
A low three, okay. I'm bending down as I write that. And Simon, from you?
I think that's definitely a three as well, but a five for her. She's a superstar.
You're giving what?
I'm giving the album three, but I'm giving her five.
Oh, fine.
And her cover of Tears of Fear's Mad
a
World
low
is good.
Three and a three that should be a five. I am totally confused. Siobhan Kane and Simon Marr, thank you so much for reviewing Dry Cleaning, John Spillane and Demi Lovato. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields. Damien Chanels was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan. Sean is back next week.